Hello and welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Atlanta Film Festival. The State Election Board tells Georgia counties to prepare for paper ballots amid voting law uncertainty. And a Republican congressman from Georgia is speaking out against President Trump's recent social media posts.
The Easter Sunday post about annihilating civilization is not okay. It's not. And posting a picture portraying yourself as Jesus is not okay.
Today is Friday, April 17th. I'm Orlando Montoya, and this is Georgia Today. A Republican congressman from Georgia is rebuking recent social media posts by President Donald Trump. South Georgia's Austin Scott made his short and to-the-point comments in an unrelated committee meeting on Tuesday.
I wish I could say this in a private conversation, but I can't, so I do want to say it. The Easter Sunday post about annihilating civilization is not okay. It's not. And posting a picture portraying yourself as Jesus is not okay. And so I would just advise all of the people at the White House that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And if you read Proverbs, you would know that. And Galatians will caution you that God will not be mocked.
And that was the entirety of his statement. Scott, who represents the 8th District, is the latest to join a rare conservative backlash following the incendiary posts. A Superior Court judge in Northeast Georgia's Barrow County today set the sentencing date for Colin Gray. He's the father who was found guilty of second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter for providing a rifle that his son, Colt Gray, allegedly used in the 2024 Appalachie High School shooting, where two teachers and two students were fatally shot. He's set to be sentenced on July 28th. Colin Gray is the first parent in Georgia to be convicted of criminal negligence that led to their child committing a crime. The State Election Board met this week but made no decisions ahead of a July 1st deadline to force local boards of election to stop using QR codes on ballots. GPB's Sarah Callis reports on how counties might have to prepare.
The State Election Board is recommending that counties get ready to conduct elections using hand-marked paper ballots after a July 1st deadline. That's unless there are changes to a 2024 law prohibiting the use of QR codes on the back of ballots to tally election results. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger says paper ballots in November could be a solution.
Yeah, we want to make sure we pull in all the, you know, key stakeholders in that, and at the end of the day, you know, make sure that voters don't have to worry about anything.
A bill that would have moved the deadline until after the November election passed the House during the legislative session, but stalled in the Senate. The only solution would be for Governor Brian Kemp to call a special session to revisit the law. For GPB News, I'm Sarah Callis.
When taken properly, medication can make HIV undetectable and prevent transmission. A new analysis of data from Emory University finds these treatments prevented more than 55,000 new cases and 36,000 deaths in Georgia over the last four decades. GPB's Ellen Eldridge has more.
The public health benefits of antiretroviral therapies that suppress HIV are more than clinical. Improved life expectancy and resulting labor market outcomes totaled more than $100 billion since 1987. Study author Patrick Sullivan is with Emory University. He says for every dollar invested in HIV treatment, the public saw a return of $3.40.
According to our analysis, antiretroviral therapy protects the health of people living with HIV, and it's also a sound investment in the South's economic well-being.
In 2023, Georgia had the highest rate of new HIV diagnoses of any state, with more than 81% of those cases affecting Black and Latino communities. For GPB News, I'm Ellen Eldridge.
Hundreds of Georgians who rely on federal rental assistance might need to relocate as emergency housing vouchers expire this summer. GPB's Amanda Andrews reports the NAACP is advocating for affected families.
Federal funding for the vouchers was allocated in 2021 and expected to last through 2030. Due to the rising cost of rent, the program will now end on June 30th. Public housing authorities in Atlanta and Columbus say they'll accept the new families. But Georgia NAACP President Gwinnett Westbrooks says many people can't just move.
People have children that they have to take out of schools, and you have, like I explained, that you have people that have jobs that they would have to leave their employment in order to be able to keep housing. So you have to make a decision which one is important, your employment or housing.
Emergency voucher recipients will also be automatically added to the Georgia Department of Community Affairs tenant-based voucher waitlist. For GPB News, I'm Amanda Andrews.
President Donald Trump has nominated a former Deputy Surgeon General to be the next director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Trump named Erica Schwartz in a social media post yesterday. Leadership at the Atlanta-based agency has been a revolving door since the administration fired former director Susan Menarez last year. Schwartz holds multiple academic credentials in both medicine and law. Central Georgia Technical College and the Houston County School District have launched a $100 million regional healthcare workforce initiative. The partners said this week that the investment includes a $10 million grant from Bloomberg Philanthropies and will advance opportunities for students in an 11-county region. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Atlanta Film Festival, a public celebration of local and international filmmakers, marquee events, and premieres. GPB's Christy York Wooten brings us this preview.
Based at the historic Plaza and Terra Theaters, the Atlanta Film Festival is a story of traditions and numbers. From April 23rd through May 3rd, the festival screened 154 films chosen from more than 5,500 submissions, plus dozens of related events and immersive experiences. Christopher Escobar is the executive director of the festival and involved in the revival of Atlanta's art house theaters.
I like to think of the Atlanta Film Festival like one of those either, you know, music clubs or comedy clubs where people who became greats first kind of proved themselves and cut their teeth. We have a really long history going back nearly all 50 years of being either one of, or in many cases, the first to play the work from people like Spike Lee, Joel Cohen, Robert Rodriguez, David Gordon Green, Ray McKinnon, James Ponsell, Walton Goggins, you know, Julie Dash, like Mark Mori. And that's a really important history that we're really proud of.
Filmmaker Mark Mori has a unique history with the Atlanta Film Festival, first in 1989 with a documentary about nuclear weapons production at the Savannah River plant.
It was announced we was going to have a bomb plant in here. I can see my mother today sitting in a rocking chair saying it's a damnation on earth.
Building Bombs was nominated for an Academy Award and returns to the Atlanta Film Festival this year, restored in 4K.
And that's why I make film. It's not just to make a film, it's to actually cause people to take action and improve what's going on. And when I got the call from the Academy, I dropped the phone. I was so shocked that it was nominated.
Mori is the only director with two films in the festival this year. His latest entry is Baristas vs. Billionaires, a Susan Sarandon-narrated documentary about the struggles of Starbucks workers in their efforts to unionize.
Shut it down!
We are tired of listening to billionaire CEOs take sole credit for the billions.
You know, I was a union member in Atlanta. Back before I made this film, I worked at Atlantic Steel over on 14th Street. That's all gone now. I was very politically active, and the company fired me, and the union got my job back. And so, you know, that experience is what really informed me in being able to make this film.
Festival goers will see work from heavy hitters and up-and-comers like Kaya Alexandria Klingman, an actor, director, and producer who shot the short film Capriccio in an Atlanta bookstore.
As Black filmmakers, sometimes we feel like we have to have a message or a strong cause, like or like a mission-driven story. But for this one, we get to just escape for 10 minutes and watch this couple transform and have a really beautiful meet cue. Like, it's fun. It's colors, it's dance, it's music, it's all of the things that we enjoy about film.
Despite shifts in the industry over the past few years, for many creatives, Atlanta is still a welcoming place to thrive.
The biggest blessing of being in Atlanta is getting to see the rise of independent filmmaking here in the city. I always am trying to amplify voices of the unheard and tell stories that other people are afraid to tell.
For Escobar, the Atlanta Film Festival is the commitment of a lifetime.
And the short of it is, it's because the Atlanta community comes together from people who volunteer to people who sponsor, donate, the staff, the board, the members of the media who help us spread the word. Like, it is very much a group effort. And like Mayor Dickens said, it is a group project. what he says with Atlanta, it's true with the Atlanta Film Festival.
The Atlanta Film Festival runs from April 23rd to May 3rd. For GPB News, I'm Christy York Wooten.
Atlanta commuters take heed as MARTA's next-gen overhaul rolls out this weekend, and nearly every bus route will change as the entire system has been redrawn. More than 30 routes will disappear. Other routes will have more frequent service. This is the Transit Authority's biggest route redesign in its history. It begins tomorrow, Saturday. MARTA is urging riders to check schedules and routes at itsmarta.com. Atlanta journalist Tom Juneau is known for his acclaimed and in-depth profiles in men's magazines, including Esquire and GQ. He's now senior writer at ESPN. His latest profile has taken him his entire life to write. In his new book, In the Days of My Youth, I Was Told What It Means to Be a Man, he takes a tough and unflinching gaze at his father, and in the process writes both an enthralling family drama and a pointed social commentary. Tom Juneau joins me now. Thanks for coming to GPB.
Thanks for having me, Orlando.
After writing so many profiles of other people, perhaps most famously Mr. Rogers,
right,
what made you turn your attention as a writer to your father, Lou, who died in 2006?
Well, you know, I'd been writing about my dad sort of all along. I think one of the first stories I ever wrote for GQ was about Frank Sinatra Jr. So that was about the difficulty of being a son. One of the stories that I did for GQ was actually about my father. It was called My Father's Fashion Tips. In a certain way, this book revisits that. So when I did My Father's Fashion Tips with my dad back in 1996, he told me a lot of things that I couldn't use in that article because he was still alive and the secrets were so radical. You know, the secrets that he told me about himself and his life were so at odds with what everybody thought, basically, in my family. And so I kept it to myself until now.
What attracted people to your father?
My father was one of the most powerfully charismatic people I've ever encountered. And I've encountered, you know, a lot of charismatic people. I've done stories on people who, you know, have made their livings out of being charismatic. But my dad was second to none in all of that. He was not just tan. He was sort of professionally tan.
He was obsessed by the sun.
He was obsessed by the sun. He was called a sun worshiper. I mean, he literally had eyes the color of creme de menthe. I mean, he had the greenest eyes of any human being I've ever seen, you know, matched against this sort of steak sauce colored skin, plus this, you know, habit of, and this insistence on wearing clothes that were flattering to him. So he was that guy. And he never let you forget that he was the most attractive person in the room.
He had a physical magnetism, but also a personal magnetism.
He did. My father, even, you know, he was a Brooklyn boy. So you would think that he would sound like, you know, one of those kids from like the East Side comedies from the, you know, the 1930s. Ah, Louie. But he didn't speak like that. He had learned his speech patterns from watching the movies. And so he spoke like this, Orlando. You ask very good questions. You know, he had a musicality of his speech. It was seductive, and it was seductive to everybody who knew him. It was seductive to men, I think, you know, who wanted to be like him, and it was seductive to women who wanted to be with him.
You describe Lou as an unabashed womanizer and philanderer, mm-hmm. someone who flaunted his sexual prowess in a kind of Marlboro Man billboard kind of way. But of course, you didn't know these words and concepts as a 9-year-old right. when you witnessed them happening. But you did know that it was toxic.
I did.
How?
From my mom. You know, I was connected to my mom sort of via central nervous system. I think that we were the same kind of person ultimately. And so I felt it when my mom felt it. And my mom felt it a lot. I think that had something to do with the fear of my dad. I think that my mother feared my dad. And so therefore, so did I.
The arguments, the fights.
The arguments, the little, you know, my mom's defense was these sort of jabs at, you know, at my dad. You know, it was like being the zebra on the Serengeti when the lion is continually pacing the room.
What in finding out the truth about your father transformed you?
Well, knowing my father's secrets when I was a child and then a boy and then a young man and now as a guy who's had a long writing career has strengthened me in some way. I mean, the thing that my dad was very successful at making me feel was weak. And so knowing his secrets gave me a kind of power. And I must say that talking about his secrets right now still gives me a kind of strength. I have felt stronger as a person since writing the book.
Do you recall some lighter moments that you had with your father?
I can go many, many, many times.
Your favorite?
My father was a sun worshiper. And so we had a house out in West Hampton Beach, Long Island, right by the water. And he would, come into the little room, or the little bunkhouse where me and, my brother and my friends would sleep. He'd be like, "All right, get up. It's time to run the beach." And we would do that. We would have to go out and mass. Whoever was there would have to go down and run the beach. And he'd be sort of exercising and doing these things. And then, as a reward for running the beach, you'd go into the ocean. And my father would go in there and go, "Nectar of the gods." And you felt exactly that. It wasn't like you were like, "This is ridiculous." You felt like you were lucky to be in that water, in his presence, in that sunlight. It was just a remarkable experience.
Where do you think your book lands in the conversation about masculinity today?
The book is more experiential than essayistic. I don't very often pull back and analyze things. I never use the phrase toxic masculinity in the book. I barely even use the word abuse or trauma. I will say, though, that especially right now, where you see masculinity becoming a sort of maybe a synonym for what it used to be, like this idea that like men don't have to apologize for anything. And that's what masculinity should be. It should allow you to sort of get away with things. My father definitely, I think, went through his life thinking he could get away with a lot and used his sort of masculine armor to do that. I have to say, though, that I don't think he got away with it. I think he did a lot of damage. I think he did a lot of damage to his family, and I think he did a lot of damage to other people outside of his family, especially some of the women that he either was in love with or just took on as lovers. You know, my father fooled a lot of people, especially men. Not so much women, but especially men. They were like his friends. They worshipped him. And you see this right now. There are just people who are out there being worshipped despite representing, in some ways, the worst of us.
That's Atlanta writer Tom Juneau, senior writer at ESPN, and the author of In the Days of My Youth, I Was Told What It Means to Be a Man. Thanks for coming to GPB.
Thanks for having me, Orlando.
Springtime in Georgia is here, and that means festival season is in full swing all over the state. This is a wonderful time to get out in your community or to visit a new community. And maybe to put an idea in your head, something to do, here are some events you can find going on this weekend. There's the Spring Fling and Backyard Barbecue Festival in Moultrie, Barbecue and Brews in Cartersville, and the first annual Chickamauga Crawfish Festival. Colquitt will host the 43rd National Mayhaw Festival and Parade. And in Darien, they'll have the annual Blessing of the Fleet, a beloved tradition in that maritime community. The Bear on the Square Mountain Festival is in Dahlonega. Thomaston will have its Art and Soul Fest, and the Bluesberry Beer and Music Festival is happening in Norcross. Now, while most of these events feature live music, there are a number of music-focused festivals around the state this weekend, just specifically music. There's the Georgia Tribute Festival in Brunswick, Sweetwater 420 Fest in Atlanta. That's a big one. The Roswell Music Festival. Downtown Hartwell will host its very first Porch Songs and Public Voices Festival. Other notable events over the weekend include Crush Reloaded Weekend 2026 in Savannah and Tybee Island, the International Street Festival in Athens, the Williamson Wisteria Festival, and the Possum Hollow Festival in Dexter. How do those possums get in hollows? We know that this is an incomplete list. I'm already thinking of Atlanta Streets Alive. How did we miss that one? If you know of an event that we missed, please email us at georgiatoday@gpb.org. We'd love to hear about upcoming events as well. That's it for today's edition of Georgia Today. If you'd like to learn more about these stories, visit gpb.org/news. If you haven't yet hit subscribe on this podcast, take a moment right now and keep us current in your podcast feed. If you have feedback, as I just said, you can email us at georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Orlando Montoya. I hope you have a great weekend.